From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we examine questions of life and death with Daniel Callahan. He's a medical ethicist and the author of a new book, What Kind of Life? The Limits of Medical Progress. Also, writer Anne Lamott tells us how growing up with an author for a father influenced her writing. Book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel from Thomas Pynchon. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers The Love and Spoonful. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. A federal judge in Miami today put off any decision on whether to consider bail for deposed Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega. The judge also ordered federal officials to keep Noriega in Miami until he rules on whether the former dictator should be moved to another detention center. The Peruvian government has filed a formal protest with the United States over the presence of U.S. troops surrounding the Peruvian embassy in Panama. Mark Day reports from Lima.
Peru's foreign ministry is acknowledging that it has granted diplomatic asylum to five members of General Manuel Antonio Noriega's defense forces, along with seven of their family members. The foreign ministry said the presence of U.S. soldiers at the embassy has created an unnecessary climate of tension, and it impedes the work of the Peruvian mission in Panama. The communique called for the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops and the normalization of democracy in Panama. President Alan Garcia has remained one of the harshest critics of U.S. military intervention in that Central American country. Garcia said he would boycott a February 15th drug summit in Colombia with President George Bush unless U.S. troops are withdrawn from Panama. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Day in Lima.
The Supreme Court ruled today that colleges and universities have no right to withhold confidential data relating to tenure decisions when schools are charged with race or sex discrimination. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1985, the University of Pennsylvania denied tenure to Rosalie Tung, an associate professor at Wharton School of Business. She filed a claim with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, charging the school with sex discrimination and discrimination based on national origin. She also claimed that her qualifications were equal to or better than five male faculty members who had received more favorable treatment, and she noted that a majority of members of the Wharton faculty had recommended her for tenure. The EEOC, upon receiving Tung's complaint, began an investigation, and when the university refused to provide some of the information the EEOC asked for, the Federal Anti-Discrimination Agency subpoenaed Tung's tenure review file and the file of the five male faculty members identified in her charge. The university went to court to block the subpoena. It argued that these files should remain confidential, that they were protected under the concept of academic freedom. But today, the Supreme Court, by unanimous vote, rejected any special privileges for colleges and universities. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Educators concerned with the schooling of minority students offered today a wide-ranging plan to restructure American education. And among the recommendations is a proposal to stop grouping elementary school students by age. A report by the Quality Education for Minorities Project said continued economic success for the nation as a whole depends on success in the education of minorities. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 28 points to close the day at 2766.00. This is NPR News. The president of the National Urban League said today reduced east-west tensions represent a narrow window of opportunity to redirect military spending to help blacks, whose economic progress was stalled during the military buildup of the 1980s. John Jacobs said the government and business leaders should use the money to develop an urban Marshall Plan and investment bank to help close the economic gap between whites and blacks and ensure American competitiveness in the 21st century. Police in France today recovered eight stolen works by the French painter Henri Matisse, which are worth about $13 million. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
French police said they arrested the alleged thief during a routine identity check in Nice in southern France. They said the suspect, 25-year-old Franck Cochet, is a known drug addict who was wanted for other robberies. Officials didn't say where they recovered the artworks, which included five oil paintings, two pencil drawings, and an etching. They were stolen from the apartment where Henri Matisse died in 1954. The apartment hasn't been lived in for more than 20 years and wasn't equipped with a burglar alarm. The robbery was discovered by the artist's daughter-in-law during a visit to the premises over the holidays. All but one of the works were painted by Henri Matisse during his youth and were considered to be minor pieces. But experts say they still would have been difficult to sell in the art market. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
A human rights group reported today that at least 200 Liberian civilians were massacred in northern Liberia. That's according to Africa Watch, which said eyewitnesses fleeing the country attribute the killings to government forces. The violence is the result of an attempt last month to topple President Samuel Doe. It was the second coup attempt against Doe in 4 years, although his accused opponents of plotting additional overthrows, which he foiled. Critics say he concocted some of the alleged plots in order to eliminate rivals. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson here while Terry Gross is on vacation. My guest, Daniel Callahan, is a philosopher residing in the world of medicine. He's the director and co-founder of the Hastings Center, a think tank that addresses the ethical questions that face our healthcare industry. Callahan's books include Setting Limits, which looks at healthcare for the elderly, and Abortion, Law, Choice, and Morality. His new book is What Kind of Life? The Limits of Medical Progress. Callahan argues that decisions on how we allocate our healthcare funds are based on values, and he questions the values behind our current healthcare priorities. He believes we spend a disproportionate amount on costly, high-tech medicine to extend life by extraordinary means, at the expense of basic care for the poor, the elderly, and children. Callahan argues for a centralized plan that would set limits on costly operations such as transplants. Daniel Callahan begins his new book with the case of Adam Howard, a young man who died of leukemia in 1987 while trying to raise $100,000 to pay for a bone marrow transplant operation. He was the first victim of a new Oregon law that stopped funding organ transplants for welfare recipients and transferred the money to prenatal care. I asked Daniel Callahan if he felt that the law that blocked this life-saving operation was cold-hearted indifference by the state.
There really was no indifference there. The voters of Oregon had earlier established a limitation on expenditures, and the state had spent all of the money the voters would allow them to spend, and the legislature had to then make a decision about where to make some fundamental cuts. And they decided that the organ transplantation program, which costs something in the vicinity of $1 million a year, really had money in it that could be better used, they felt, for prenatal care. And what they did was transfer the money from transplantation to prenatal care. And the net result was they helped some 1,500 women, but at the cost possibly of the loss of one or two lives of people who might have been saved by organ transplant. So it was not indifference or insensitivity. I would bring the question right back to the whole idea of voters telling legislatures you can only spend so much money, because you really see the consequences here. You leave very hard decisions in the hands of officials, and there's no happy choice they can make in that case.
You've advocated a basic national level of health care, a guaranteed minimal level of care that would take care of the basics to basically keep us all going day in and day out, in part so that we could continue to take care of ourselves. But there will have to be limits attached to this. And I'm wondering about this idea of limits. When you're standing next to the bedside of somebody who could be improved by an incremental advance or application of some technology, and somebody has decided, no, that person can't have that medicine, can't have that treatment, I think that sort of really focuses away from the abstract and onto the personal in a way that would make it very hard to make a decision like you're advocating.
It is very hard where it has to take place, such as happened in Oregon a couple of years, and it's inevitably going to be hard. I think what one has to understand, however, is that if you don't make these hard decisions, you're going to pay a price somewhere else. If you don't say no to certain kinds of expensive treatment, you can be pretty sure you're probably going to be hurting the health of some other people, or you're going to be hurting other social goods. I suppose the real tragedy here, and for me the hardest part of all this, is what do you do with those very touching, very demanding individual cases? I think we have to keep in mind that the human body does eventually age and die. We will decline. We are mortal creatures. So inevitably, there's going to come a point where we're going to be on a trajectory of decline, and it may be simply reasonable to say, look, even though we could do more, perhaps we shouldn't try because simply we have to accept death.
The medical profession has advanced technically so far that it seems that, with the exception, I think, of AIDS and terminal cancer, just about anything seems to be curable nowadays, sometimes at great expense. Are you saying this is no longer a wise decision that doctors should make or patients should make?
The problem is that we have found more and more expensive ways to keep human bodies going. We know how to take care of very low birth weight babies. We know how to take care of very elderly people. We know how to take care of people whose organs are failing. The problem is that the progress is enormously expensive. There turn out to be very few inexpensive ways any longer of saving and prolonging life. 50 or 100 years ago, when we were still dealing with infectious disease, smallpox or diphtheria or typhoid, then we were able eventually to come up with the vaccines and find inexpensive treatments. But now we're dealing with cancer and heart disease and stroke and Alzheimer's. Those diseases turn out to be very expensive to control. So the problem is, how in the world are we going to pay for the high cost of further medical progress and at the same time not bankrupt ourselves and actually do ourselves some good?
Several years ago, I remember seeing the first sonogram machines and was startled to see that you could actually look at the living, moving organs inside the body with ultrasound, a non-intrusive, non-invasive, and relatively benign way of examining the human body. And this seemed to be a wonderful form of technology, but I was also seeing it through the viewpoint then of the people who were inventing the machines and devising them and marketing them. And this particular sonogram that was being sold was black and white. There were plans to introduce a color model that would be more expensive. And eventually, the sonogram machine became a very elaborate tool that's used extensively now. But there's an entire sort of electronics, medical technology industry that's driving some of this. Are you saying slow down, stop inventing devices such as the sonogram machine?
I admit that I am highly ambivalent and troubled on this particular issue. I think it's very difficult to say out loud, look, let's stop progress, let's slow down progress, let's somehow put the brakes on our understanding of human nature and biology. At the same time, it seems to me that if we develop all kinds of expensive devices, drugs, what have you, inevitably there's enormous pressure toward using them. It's very hard to have something that will benefit somebody and then not to use it. So I suppose I would like, my compromise, I suppose, would be to just say, look, we've got to have progress. It's a good thing, but let's go at it very carefully. Let's look before we leap. Let's begin to consider what the economic consequences of the technology will be, what some of the social, what some of the cultural consequences are going to be. And then if we still think it's worth it, let's go ahead. What I suppose I want is a real sense of foresight and prudence and care. I mean, the sonogram is a wonderful example of something that does have benefits. It does provide knowledge of the fetus, which can be very valuable. Frequently, of course, that knowledge has led to a greater use of cesareans, which drives the cost of health care up. And at the same time as we were developing the sonogram, keep in mind we were also seeing a continuing development of prenatal diagnosis and other means of monitoring the health of fetuses. So if you look back over a period of 20 years and ask, my gosh, what has happened to childbirth, what you see is not just a sonogram. You see a whole array of technological developments, which has radically driven up the cost of having a child. Now, we're getting healthier children for the most part out of that. Though, ironically, at least with the poor, we're often getting sicker children because they're not having access, they're not even getting old-fashioned prenatal care. But on the whole, what we see is not just one technology with childbirth, but you're seeing a whole lot of technologies, and it's the total impact which really creates the problem, I believe. We'll have to slow this down. We can't keep going forward as fast as we do. Yet, at the same time, that won't be easy because it goes against our grain to talk about slowing down progress.
My guest is Daniel Callahan, author of the book, What Kind of Life? The Limits of Medical Progress. Given the amount of money that's gone into AIDS research, do you feel that this is a worthwhile investment vis-a-vis other costs? I certainly know that I've heard doctors say, why should we treat people who have AIDS? They won't live very long anyway. These kinds of issues seem to be getting right to the heart of what you're interested in.
Oh, absolutely. The AIDS crisis is a sort of horrible test case, I suppose. There are really three things to be thought about when considering AIDS. First of all, money to be spent on basic research looking for a cure for the disease. Secondly, money spent on education and prevention campaigns, trying to keep the disease from spreading. Thirdly, money to be spent on health care for people who actually come down with AIDS. To me, the most important thing would be the first two phases, the research phase, simply because it is an infectious disease. We want to stop it. It's imperative that we stop it. Secondly, it's important that we try to educate people to behave in ways that will keep them from getting the disease in the first place. That's fundamental to keep the burden down. And thirdly, we then have to ask the question, well, how much and what kind of money should we spend on those who have had the misfortune to actually get the disease? To me, part of that is very troubling. What we're coming to, I believe, is we're finding more and more very expensive ways to keep AIDS victims alive. AZT is a pretty good example, costing now anywhere from $6,000 to $8,000 a year. It's helpful, it's important for AIDS victims, but it's enormously expensive. What I foresee in the future is we may well find some increasingly expensive ways to extend the life of AIDS victims, but not save those lives. We'll turn it into a very expensive kind of a long-term chronic disease. That, to me, is very, very troubling. And I suppose the question that I puzzle about is, how much should we spend on the education, the research side, over against the therapy side for those that have it? My own bias, I suppose, in general, with limited resources, is to spend the money for the research and the education. But at the same time, it's very hard to say no to something that can extend the life of an AIDS victim.
And there are clearly those who have AIDS who are quite adventuresome in the world of in the way of seeking out possible cures, and almost running head on into the bureaucracies in this country. Who are saying, no, we won't let you try this new drug, we won't let you try that new treatment, whereas they are expressing an interest in trying anything possible. It seems to me there's a new advocacy coming from people who have AIDS that we haven't seen from patients before.
Well,
there's a political issue involved, too.
That's true. The AIDS, many of the organizations that are looking at for AIDS victims are very vocal, and they're very effective lobbying groups, and they've certainly brought about some fundamental changes in the release of experimental drugs. It's interesting that, I mean, there are many more cancer victims in this country, many more people who are trying to get very experimental cancer drugs that can't get them. Yet their complaints over the years pretty much went unheeded. And the reason, of course, was not a bad reason. There really have been very strong efforts to keep off the market quack remedies, things that will actually do more harm than good. And it's very, very important to really adequately test drugs to find out what works and what doesn't work. The AIDS advocates have pretty much cracked through that earlier system of cautions and barriers, and they made a big difference. Sometimes I suppose the difference is beneficial. And yet, at the same time, in a way, there are many other victims of many other diseases that aren't getting nearly the attention that the AIDS people are getting.
My guest is Daniel Callahan, the director of the Hastings Center, a think tank that studies ethical questions in medicine. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Daniel Callahan, author of the book, What Kind of Life? The Limits of Medical Progress. One of the issues, particularly in the Bay Area, is that the emergency rooms are often filled with people who have been either dealing crack or been involved in a crack or a cocaine deal and have been shot or stabbed or beaten up in some way, where emergency rooms are now being turned over to people who are involved in the crack business. This is putting an enormous strain on the emergency rooms there. What kind of ethical questions do you see being raised here?
Oh, gosh, the The state of emergency rooms in many of, if not most of our large cities, is absolutely terrible. There's an enormous problem, certainly in New York City and in the Bay Area, but it's also true in Houston, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., everywhere. There are a couple of ethical problems that are raised here. First of all, if we really try to meet the demand and increase the emergency room facilities, then, of course, unless we're prepared to see a great increase in taxes, we're going to have to take money from other health care needs. So that's one dilemma. How do you balance off the emergency room needs, particularly with problems generated by the whole drug crisis, over against other health care needs? I suppose the problem also that surfaces, people talk about at any rate, is how can we justify spending large amounts of money for people who are actually bringing their problems upon themselves by engaging in a life of violence and crime? Because what happens in many of these emergency rooms is that the same people come back again and again, particularly not just the victims of gunshot and wounds and stabbing wounds that come from sort of the commercial fights that go on in the drug scene, but of course people who are themselves drug addicts who come back for the third, fourth, fifth time. Many people who are drug addicts develop very serious heart problems, and I've talked with any number of emergency room physicians and who say, look, it's an enormous frustration when you see the same patient coming back for the fourth time with the same heart condition brought on by the same addiction. And what do you do? How do you justify spending tens of thousands of dollars to pull this patient through again, knowing he's going to go right back out on the streets, develop the very same condition, and be back in here again? The ethic of medicine says that you should treat regardless of how people get sick, and that's a wonderful ethic. On the same time, we're developing an emergency room situation where all sorts of legitimate needs are going unmet, and we're really largely catering to what is really a social crisis in this country, which is sort of has a terrible medical spin-off, but is essentially not. I mean, the drug crisis is not ultimately a medical problem, but it sure produces lots of medical casualties.
How did you decide to become a medical ethicist?
Well, my background is in philosophy, and I've had a long-standing interest back to my graduate school days in moral philosophy. And toward the end of the 1960s, I became interested really in taking philosophy much more out into the world, much as Socrates did out into the marketplace. And it seemed obvious at that time that one of the major areas of moral concern, moral dilemma, would be the area of medicine. Even 20, 25 years ago, organ transplantations were just beginning. Questions were being raised about the definition of death. And, of course, we had the abortion debate, which is still with us. We've had debates about surrogate motherhood, artificial reproduction. And it was pretty obvious that these moral problems were going to be very important. They were going to be very tough. And it struck me that there was a wonderful role, a kind of new role for philosophers, and I decided to really turn my interest in that direction.
I'm curious what role a medical ethics center has within the larger medical community. How is it viewed by practitioners in the field of medicine?
Well, the Hastings Center, which I direct, has now been in existence 20 years. 20 years ago, when we began, I think reasonable to say that there was a great deal of suspicion, sometimes even hostility, and just an enormous amount of indifference. That has changed very significantly. The interesting thing is that many of the ethical issues that were seen as kind of science fiction problems or at the fringe of medicine have now come to the very center of medicine. Certainly there have been enormous changes in the doctor-patient relationship. We now talk much more about the rights of patients, the necessity of physicians to really have good, open, solid dialogue with their patients. The physicians themselves recognize the enormous financial pressures their patients are under and, in fact, the enormous financial pressures faced by the whole system. So in general, I find them very interested, very receptive, puzzled like the rest of us, but as a group, quite prepared to deal with the ethical problems and quite willing to understand that we face some tough choices, that those choices have to be shared, really be shared between doctors and lay people. in the history of medicine, it was very uncommon for doctors to really talk with anyone other than doctors about moral problems. And I suppose over the past 20 years, perhaps the most dramatic change has been that the ethical issues are now discussed very openly, obviously in the media. They're discussed between doctors and patients. They've really come to the very heartland of medicine itself.
In part, wasn't a lot of this sort of fueled by lawsuits in which doctors suddenly found themselves answering for decisions that they had made before that they had not had to talk about before?
There's no doubt that probably by the mid-70s, there were a whole range of court cases that began to develop in this area. There were disputes between doctors and patients. The most famous, I suppose, in the 1970s was the Karen Ann Quinlan case, where the parents of that young woman wanted to have treatment stopped on her. The doctors did not want to stop the treatment, and they took that case to the New Jersey Supreme Court, and the court decided eventually in favor of the parents. That was followed by a whole string of court cases, and they go on to this very day. Right now, there's a case before the United States Supreme Court, the Nancy Cruzan case, about which bears on the stopping of artificial nutrition and hydration. So there have been, every year there's been a major court case, it seems. And increasingly, too, these issues are being taken to legislatures, which are passing laws and establishing policies and trying to come to grips with these problems.
I wonder if there's been anything in your own life that has raised these issues for you in a very immediate way.
Two or three things raised them. First of all, I have adult children, and I became aware a few years ago of how difficult it is for them to buy housing. And one thing that began striking me was that the resources in this country that are going to the elderly have now begun to very significantly exceed resources going to the young. I suppose, secondly, I have seen more and more people dying amidst a very costly treatment, and particularly seeing more and more people who have become almost really fearful of contemporary medicine. They're afraid that they're going to be impoverished. They're going to have to spend an enormous amount of money on their health care, which is going to financially ruin them. They have become scared of spending their lives demented for many years, say, in a nursing home. And people talk about that a lot, and particularly, what I see is that sort of the next age group up, the people 10 or 15 years older than myself, are living out these problems, and it's getting nearer and nearer to my own case, and I'm trying to think a bit ahead. My gosh, what do I want when I'm older? What would count as a good healthcare system? And yet at the same time, I don't want to sort of promote a healthcare system that is going to impoverish the young of the country or so imbalance things toward one group that other social needs just go wanting. I'm also, I suppose, I've become very interested in recent years in the fate of the American education system. I'm very disturbed to see our relative standing compared with all other countries is declining. Our kids seem to know less and less. Our schools seem to be poorer and poorer. But meanwhile, we spend more and more money on health care. And I suppose when I ask about the future of a country, my own guess is the future is probably going to be determined much more by what we spend on education in this country than it is by what we spend on health care.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming and being with us on Fresh Air today. Daniel Callahan is the director and co-founder of the Hastings Center and author of the new book, What Kind of Life? The Limits of Medical Progress. I'm Sej Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, film director Michael Moore, whose new documentary, Roger and Me, has become the most talked about and widely distributed documentary film ever. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sej Thompson with Fresh Air. When Anne Lamott was growing up, the neighborhood kids thought her dad was weird because he stayed at home all day writing instead of commuting to a city office like everyone else's father. Now Anne Lamott stays home herself, writing articles and so far four novels. Coming up, Anne Lamott tells us about her latest novel, All New People. Also, book critic John Leonard assesses Thomas Pynchon's new novel called Vineland. It's Pynchon's first novel in more than 15 years. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles the rise and fall of the Lovin' Spoonful. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. attorneys in Miami gave Manuel Noriega's attorneys notice today that the U.S. government is planning to move the former Panamanian leader in the near future. But as Jeff White reports, a federal judge said that no such move can be made without his prior knowledge.
U.S. Attorney Dexter Leighton declared that the government has the right to move Noriega whenever and wherever it wants to. He said the U.S. will dispose of the prisoner as it sees fit, and he confirmed that the government was considering a move. Defense Attorney Stephen Cullen objected to that line of thinking, saying he wants ready access to his client. He said the defense would strenuously oppose any plan to move Noriega outside of South Florida because such a move would affect his ability to represent his client properly. Federal Judge William Hoover directed that Noriega not be moved without consulting the court and the defense attorneys first. A pretrial detention hearing will be held January 26th to determine if Noriega will be released on bond. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
The government of Peru said today that it has granted diplomatic asylum to a dozen Panamanians at the residence of its ambassador in Panama City. The embassy has been surrounded by U.S. troops since yesterday. The government of Peru has filed a formal protest with the U.S. over its deployment of troops in Panama. Pentagon officials said today that an estimated 220 Panamanian civilians were killed in the invasion last month of Panama, a figure which is a much smaller number than estimates of critics of the operation. West Berlin authorities today decided to release a former Communist Party official wanted on corruption charges in East Germany. Deidre Berger reports from Berlin.
The former East German Foreign Ministry official was released from a West Berlin jail today after West Berlin authorities refused to extradite him to East Germany. Alexander Schalk-Golodkowski spent a month in detention after turning himself in to West Berlin authorities. He escaped from East Germany after his role managing the Communist Party's hard currency reserves became public. After his escape, he arranged for $30 million in Swiss bank accounts to be transferred back to East Germany. The West Berlin prosecutor's office said East German charges against Schalk-Golodkowski of corruption and misuse of office were too nebulous to keep him in prison. His current whereabouts are unknown. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Berlin.
After a series of delays, the space shuttle Columbia had a letter-perfect launch this morning at Cape Canaveral. It was the start of a search and rescue mission for a scientific satellite drifting back to Earth. The flight starts a decade in which shuttles will transport astronauts and materials to build America's space station. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 28 points to close at 2,766 on volume of some 155 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In its day, the Lovin' Spoonful churned out a number of hits that weren't quite folk and not quite rock and roll. Rock historian Ed Ward has this look at the band and the McDougal street scene that inspired it.
In 1965, Bob Dylan shocked New York's snobbish folk music community by releasing an album called Bringing It All Back Home, which featured electric instrumentation. Of course, nobody who knew him was shocked. He'd tried electric stuff since the beginning on unreleased sessions, and his previous album, Another Side of Bob Dylan, sounded like a rock and roll album with the backing tracks left off of it. But scattered around Greenwich Village were a few musicians who knew deep in their hearts that they weren't Appalachian ballad singers, not really, and that their careers owed as much to Chuck Berry as to Roscoe Holcomb. You can find them playing in pickup bands at places like the Night Owl or the Café Hua, places where the cool people would never find them. Some of them decided they liked it, too, and decided to try for the big time.
I've been listening to my radio for 2 or 3 years, and the music they're playing is stuck on bad, and it's offending to my ears. But them kids come over from Mercy Rebel, made us think back till then. So let's put on the shoes and think about the blues and start all over again with that good.
Elektra Records was New York's top folk label, and they didn't really know if they wanted to get involved in this new stuff. They did, however, spring for a band that called itself the Lovin' Spoonful to make a 4-song demo tape, part of which we've just heard. The Lovin' Spoonful was led by John Sebastian, who had impeccable folky credentials and was the son of a famous harmonica virtuoso. Good Time Music was just about the band's credo. They felt it was time to take American music back from Tin Pan Alley, invest it with the do-it-yourself feeling the folkies had and the reverence for the classics the British had, and make rock and roll special again.
Do you believe in magic in a young girl's heart? How the music can free her whenever it starts, and it's magic if the music is groovy and makes you feel happy like an old-time movie. I'll tell you about the magic and the free.
Elektra Records dragged its feet, and the band was snatched up by Kama Sutra, a new company that thought it had just bought the American Beatles and was rewarded by the band's very first single, Do You Believe in Magic, heading straight into the top 10. For the New York hipsters, this was perfect. Just as the Beatles had come from Liverpool's Matthew Street club scene, so the Spoonful was from the McDougal Street folk scene. They'd even had their picture taken in front of the famous Tim Hardin is a Bad Boy graffiti in Minetta Lane. And over the next year, they managed no fewer than 8 top 10 hits. But no less importantly, they continued to proselytize for the kind of music they liked, be it traditional or written by their fellow village folkies.
Would you like to know a secret just between you and me? I don't know where I'm going next, don't know where I'm gonna be. And there's another side to this life.
Spoonful's success inspired others. Cass Elliott and Denny Doherty had been in a band with Sebastian and Spoonful guitarist Zal Yanofsky, and they went on to become half of the Mamas and Papas. Henry St. Clair Fredericks, a black guitarist who'd played the folk clubs using the name Taj Mahal, formed a band in L.A. called the Rising Suns, featuring a guitar player named Ryland P. Cooter, and got a deal with Columbia. Harry Miller, who called himself Jesse Colin Young, remembered Young Blood, the record he'd made that John Sebastian had played on, and formed the Young Bloods, a band to record his rocked-up folk material.
Well!
Before long, even Joan Baez was taking a stab at something resembling rock and roll. Pardon me if I don't play you any. As for the band that had started it all, it fell victim to the counterculture it had helped set in motion. After a Lovin' Spoonful show in Berkeley, Zal Yanofsky and bassist Steve Boone were arrested for pot and made a deal to get out of it. They set up the guy who'd gotten it for them. They probably thought nobody would ever know, but it was 1967, and the underground press blazoned the story from coast to coast. Not even the Teeny Boppers would touch them, and Yanofsky was forced out of the group. Then John Sebastian left, and by 1968, the Lovin' Spoonful, like most of the rock folk bands and the McDougal Street scene itself, was history.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Didn't wanna have to do it. Didn't wanna have to break your heart. Didn't wanna have to do it. I kept hoping from the very start, but you kept on trying, and I knew that you'd end up crying, and I knew I didn't wanna have to do it.
This is Fresh Air. Writer Anne Lamott's four novels are set in Marin County, California, where she grew up. Three of her novels, Hard Laughter, Rosie, and her latest, All New People, include a father figure or a writer who has characteristics similar to her own father, novelist Kenneth Lamott. I wondered what kind of influence he had on her decision to become a writer.
I began by being deeply ashamed of him being a writer instead of having what we thought was a job. My brother and I thought he couldn't hold down a regular job, and on a few occasions it filled me with despair if I'd brought girls home after school and he was still in there typing away. But I grew up in a family where everyone was reading all the time. You know, we went to the library every single Thursday night and we got a week's worth of books.
So in many ways, I mean, you had an apprenticeship around your father, seeing how a journeyman worked without kind of a romantic ideal of a writer or a writer's life.
Yeah, I didn't have a romantic ideal of it because my father made a living at writing, but it wasn't the kind of living that writers are making now. They weren't having those massive seven and high six-figure advances then, and it was just sort of a regular living. There was always almost exactly the right amount of money, so I didn't grow up thinking I could be a writer and make a fortune.
What did you think when you saw a piece of his come out in a magazine?
Usually I was very excited and proud, although he was very left-wing and progressive, and I wanted to fit in. You know, I was a child, and of course I wanted to be like everybody else. And when I was about 12 years old, I think, which would have been 66, he wrote an article in Horizon, which I'm not sure if it's that magazine's even around anymore, but it talks in it about having spent the afternoon out at Stinson Beach with his writer friends, having been drinking red jug wine and smoking pot. And see, dope hadn't hit yet. Marijuana hadn't hit. It wasn't okay yet. You know, I thought he was like William Burroughs or something, you know, and it was a very shabby thing to have done. And I mentioned it in this book, of course, again, because I thought it was so telling about how I was at that age. I marched into the living room holding the article. And I said, Daddy, you have brought shame upon this family. And then, of course, the next year, when I was 13, it was incredibly hip to have a father who would smoke pot, you know, and be one of the guys.
So when you were little, you saw your father disappear into this room dressed in the frumpy flannels. Now that you're going into a room wearing maybe frumpy flannels, too, do you have any empathy or connection with your father? Are you sort of startled to find yourself now also a writer?
I thought being a writer was somewhat more romantic. I didn't know that it was really so agonizing on a daily basis. I thought most writers sat down and just started writing and knew what they were doing every day and wrote 1,000 words and then called it a day and dusted off their hands and then started having drinks. But it isn't like that at all. It's really about sitting down and kind of wrestling with your demons for a while. I mean, I don't ever sit down and say, God, I feel like $1 million today and I know exactly what I'm doing and I'm happy to be here. I sit down and I immediately leap up from the desk and I run to the kitchen. I do something I think needs to be done there. And then I sit back down and I stare at the blank page for about 5 seconds. And then I think that I immediately have to call a dentist and inquire about orthodontia or something. You know, I mean, I'm 35 and maybe it's time. And it will have never crossed my mind once before in my entire life. And then I'll sit back down and I'll write several sentences and they'll be dreadful. and then I'll cross them off and I'll start again, and then I'll leap up and I'll think, as soon as I make this one phone call, I'll buckle back down. And there's a lot of up-down time. That's why I budget 5 hours to work three. Luckily, I have sort of a commitment to every month, which is a food review for California Magazine. So,
how do you divvy up your time between, is it easy to shift between being a novelist to being a food reviewer?
And back when I was a novelist, which I'm not right now, I don't have a novel in mind, and I don't have the stamina to write a novel right now. There's really a tremendous amount of tension involved in writing a novel. There's a lot of plates you need to keep spinning in the air, and you have to keep kind of running underneath them and get one going again, and then the other one over to the right starts to slow down. You have to tear over there and get it spinning. And
so you consider yourself only a novelist when you're writing a novel?
The fact that
you've got four? It's an interesting semantic question.
Is that a trick question, Serge?
It's not a trick question.
I guess I consider myself a novelist without a novel. It's sort of like The Stranger in the Strange Land or something. I don't know what it's like, but when I was working on All New People and doing the food review, I would know that the food review would take 2 days out of the month, and so I would budget that in, and it would always be, when you have a novel going, you're so excited, you're basically so happy to have all these characters that you are enjoying working with, and this thing is sort of evolving like in a Polaroid, a Polaroid photograph. You start off with a very hazy picture of something and a sense of who you want to work with and where you are in time and place. And little by little, just like a Polaroid, it's emerging, getting very vivid and bright. And writing a food review isn't. I still sit down and think, I better go do the dishes. And then I sit down and go, come on, honey, let's try to get the food review written. And I write two lousy sentences. And then I start to think about orthodontia and whether I should find a good orthodontist. And I think it was Muriel Spark that felt that she had a dictaphone on and she was just taking dictation from God, which I think is a completely appalling, heinous, and hostile way to feel. But I don't at all.
It makes you sound envious.
Yes, very. It's just pulling teeth a lot for me.
And yet you keep coming back to it.
Yeah. Well, I'm completely unemployable. There's nothing I can do.
All New People deals with a family that becomes kind of extended because of separations and pregnancies and mixed up love. There's a lot of drama that goes on mm-hmm. amongst this family.
Yeah.
Is this a drama based on your own experiences in life, and a need to put dramatic and complicated family love and issues all in a book on a page?
None of the main characters are real. The very religious mother is secretly me. My father is real in the book. He was a writer. There was no Aunt Peg, and there was no Uncle Ed, and there was no Natalie getting pregnant by Uncle Ed, since there was no Uncle Ed. And a lot of the stuff didn't really happen, but the emotional sense of the book really happened. The feeling of loss. If anyone asks what the book is about, I would really say it's about loss. It's about loss of childhood and loss of self. It's about the loss of a town. A lot of very painful stuff happened in that town, and so that part's true. But the facts of the Goodman, the fictional Goodman story, are not true at all. The migraines are true. All the migraine stuff is really true, and it was. I think it really shaped me. I think to be a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old with migraine headaches is to go through life feeling like a mental patient, and to feel profoundly different than everybody else. I mean, Updike had his psoriasis. Is that what he had?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it really sets you apart, and it really gets the old jungle drums of shame beating pretty loudly in you to not be able to control this thing that happens every so often, maybe at a birthday party, or maybe at the theater, or maybe at the Nutcracker, and all of a sudden this thing is happening that's like the alien, something from within you is causing you to no longer be an okay person. And of course the desperation of childhood is to be okay, to fit in, and I couldn't, because all of a sudden this white light would start showing up behind my eyes and I'd start hearing the distant drone of mosquitoes, and it would mean a headache was coming.
Do you still get the
no
migraines?
I grew out of them. Mm-hmm. Thank God. When I was about 17 years old, I never had another one.
Your stories and these experiences all seem to say that you like taking small pleasures in life. I mean, you see small things, these details, these small achievements. Having 4 novels published at the age of 36 is an achievement, but
35.
It seems 30. but the real triumphs are in getting a line down on page.
Yeah, I write small books. I don't write big sweeping panoramas. I don't understand them. I don't understand the big picture. I just understand these small... I understand that it is human love that saves us over and over again, and I understand that we find families for ourselves as adults that were maybe not the family of origin, but that are the families in which we find the nourishment and the feedback and the teasing and the companionship and the understanding and the everything we need to grow and to keep growing, and that's all I write about. I write about families.
I should say that you are a friend of mine. I've known you for about 5 years, and in fact, we are in kind of an extended family of our own, which we call the Reading Group.
Yes.
In San Francisco.
That's right.
How has this fulfilled a role of family for you, the idea of a reading group where we nominally get together to read a book?
I love the nominally part. The thing I love most about our reading group is that we read so little. You know, we get together and we gossip, and then we mule and puke about how difficult our own work has been that day, and then we mule and puke some more about the latest slings and arrows we've suffered at the hands of the cruel publishing world, and then we talk about books, which we all love so deeply. And I think that's probably what my father was doing. He was sitting around with the red wine and a lot of Evan Cannell and Calvin Kentfield and a lot of old Bay Area writers, and they gossiped and they complained, and it also gives me that sense of that I'm not different, that it is a painstaking process to write a book or an article or a review or in anything, and that the rest of you aren't sitting down feeling like $1 million and typing out your things. You know, you sit there and you're tortured a lot of the time, and the low self-esteem kicks in, and it says you aren't any good, and it says the well has run dry, and it says that you aren't going to get the magic to happen again. And when we're all admitting to that, it gives me a strange sense of faith, you know, that as long as I'm doing it like everybody else, I may try to do it for one more day.
Well, Anne Lamott, thank you very much for coming and being with us on Fresh Air today.
Great. You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
Writer Anne Lamott. Her new novel, All New People, is published by North Point Press. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later today on National Public Radio is today's edition of All Things Considered, and host Robert Siegel has joined us to describe today's news. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Sedge. We're going to be hearing today about the Comic-Con meeting. That's the Soviet bloc economic grouping of all of the Soviet Union and its allies. They're meeting in Sofia, Bulgaria today. Also about vacancies finally being filled in the Bush administration, which is almost a year old, and whether there's been any real damage to the operation of the government that so many key positions have been unfilled for so long. In addition, we will hear about shuffling cards. It takes 7 shuffles to achieve a random deck. Big frogs, whether it's fair to have them jump against normal-sized frogs, and lots of other things.
Thanks, Robert. A full show later here on National Public Radio. Thomas Pynchon achieved great critical and popular success in the 60s and early 70s with his novels The Crying of Lot 49, V, and Gravity's Rainbow. But then, to the disappointment of his fans, he went silent. Now, 17 years after Gravity's Rainbow, Pynchon has just come out with a new novel called Vineland. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Vineland, in Thomas Pynchon's brilliant and wacky new novel, refers to the wine country in Northern California. It seems also to refer to Vinland in the Old Norse sagas, what Vikings called America. We are still arguing about how far these Vikings got in their dragon ships. What looks to be an Icelandic tower in Newport, Rhode Island needs explaining, and so do some Minnesota runestones. And for all we know, the bearded white god known to pre-Columbian Mexico as Quetzalcoatl may have been a Viking too, come down the Mississippi to the Gulf Stream. All this suits Thomas Pynchon just fine. He is singing some more Norse sagas. In Pynchon's Vineland, in 1984, the year of Reagan's re-election, some refugees from the 1960s are having a hard time. Zoid Wheeler, who used to deal dope and play piano in a surfer rock band, is a freelance roofer trying to take care of his teenage daughter, Prairie. Prairie's in love with a heavy metal neo-fascist and misses the mother she hasn't seen since babyhood. This mother, the almost mythical Farnese, belonged in the 1960s to a revolutionary film collective, but she was more or less abducted by a malign federal prosecutor, Brock Vond, and turned into an undercover agent for the FBI. But Justice Department budget cuts have disemployed Farnese, not to mention Hector Zuniga, a drug enforcement agent addicted to television. Hector warns Zoid that Brock, in a funk to find Farnese, intends to kidnap Prairie, besides burning down all the marijuana crops in Northern California. When the feds invade Vineland, Zoid and Prairie are assisted in their resistance by the woman warrior, D.L. Chastain, by the Sisterhood of Kanushi Attentives, a convent of ninjets in the business of karmic adjustment, by Vato and Blood, who steal cars and traffic with ghosts, by Japanese gangsters, mafia dropouts, punk rockers, and three generations of left-wing California wobblies. I don't want to make this sound any more complicated than it already is, and I haven't even mentioned the Thanatoids, a boneless tribe of the half-dead who wait in vain for revenge and explanations. But you must understand that Vineland is an imaginary nation of 60s metaphors. Television, Buddhism, revolution, drugs, rock and roll, Vietnam, paranoia, and repression. As we might expect from the author of V, The Crying of Lot 49, and Gravity's Rainbow, Pynchon knows more about all of these things than any other novelist, with the possible exceptions of Don DeLillo and William Burroughs, as well as phrenology, photography, labor history, Hollywood movie making, martial arts, and the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Every name in the novel has another meaning. For instance, Weed Atman of the People's Republic of Rock and Roll. And every other page is hilarious. Imagine, for instance, a TV movie starring Woody Allen as the young Kissinger. By Tube Light, in prime time, in Orwell's 1984, America, meaning its law enforcement agencies, is at war with Vineland, by which Pynchon means our children, the counterculture, and its associated decencies. According to this dazzling book of the not-quite-dead, daring to quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, there will be a secret retribution and a divine justice.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Vineland by Thomas Pynchon. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Roberta Shorrock and Joan Tuohy, with assistance from Karen Impola. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet filmmaker Michael Moore. His movie, Roger and Me, is a surprise hit this season. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has some straight talk about doublespeak, and we learn about the search for adopted children by parents who'd given them up decades earlier. Next time on Fresh Air.